Disc 25.
Every time a senator had to walk a long way to reach the Capitol subway, and knew that other senators with more conveniently located offices had a shorter distance to walk, he was reminded of what Lyndon Johnson could do for him or to him. After a while, as Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote, insiders could recognize Johnson's allies by one look at the roster of office suites. The larger suites were reserved for friends, the smaller were allotted to the troublesome ones. There had been a facade of courtesy in his dealings with other senators, even those senators who were not part of the team. Now that facade dropped away. In the pile of message slips on his desk, there would be notations that Senator Lehman called, please call him back. Senator Douglas called, please call him. Senator Kefauver called, would like to speak to you. When he saw such slips, a thin smile would cross Lyndon Johnson's face. Crumpling them up, he would throw them in his wastepaper basket. Or Walter Jenkins would be reading off the messages from his yellow legal pad, writing beside each one Johnson's instructions for dealing with it. When he got to one from a senator who wasn't on the team, there would be a silence. Jenkins would read the next message. He wouldn't return Lehman's phone calls for days on end, recalls Lehman's administrative assistant, Julius Gaius Caesar Edelstein. He might not return them at all, and his men, Clements, Skeeter, Bobby Baker, wouldn't return them either. When in 1955 this first began happening, Lehman, himself the soul of courtesy, a man who, as governor, would never have dreamt of snubbing even an avowed enemy, could hardly believe it was intentional. But after one incident in 1955, he had no choice but to believe. He first had difficulty reaching Johnson, who was at the ranch, being told he was out hunting, as he was to recall. When he finally spoke to him, Johnson promised that he would deal with the matter immediately, and that either he or Earl Clements would call him back. I even gave him the number of my hotel room and told him that if I should be out, he or Earl should leave word that they had called and I would call back as promptly as possible, Lehman was to tell Edelstein. Neither Johnson nor Clements ever called. The facade dropped away in the cloakroom, too. Johnson would be standing in the middle of it, talking, laughing with a group of senators. A Lehman or a Douglas or a Kefauver or another senator not on the team would walk in. Johnson would turn away so that he wouldn't be facing them, so that they couldn't become part of the group. And some of the other senators, men attuned to nuances of power, would take their cue from the majority leader. Edelstein was to recall what it was like to be walking with Herbert Lehman after it became clear that he was in the leader's disfavor. You'd walk into the cloakroom, people would fall silent. You'd walk down the hall, and there would be an averting of eyes so that they wouldn't have to say hello. The facade dropped away on the Senate floor as well. Lehman would begin making a speech, and if Johnson was on the floor, he would walk out to the cloakroom, just ostentatiously enough so you knew it was deliberate. And other people would drift, leave the floor. Or they would not come out onto the floor, as they otherwise might have done. While Lehman or Douglas or Kefauver was speaking, a senator would wander into the cloakroom, intending to go out on the floor. Bobby Baker would be standing by the swinging doors leading from the cloakroom to the floor. He would say to the senator, "Why don't you stay in the cloakroom for a while?" There were methods of humiliating a senator on the floor as well. Johnson would go over to Douglas's desk while the Illinois senator was sitting with one of his assistants. He would lean over and chat with the assistant, ignoring Douglas. And there were methods less public than these, but with certain senators equally effective. Skeeter would routinely have the boys back to his office at 5 or 6 o'clock, Douglas's administrative assistant Howard Schumann recalls. The invited senators would walk through the tall, dark door into those cheery rooms beyond, their arms around each other's shoulders, chuckling or laughing. Other senators would see them going in. It was hard not to see. Skeeter's office was just outside the cloakroom. Paul was almost never invited, Schumann says. In fact, once when he was, he told me about it. In the telling, Douglas tried to make a joke of the situation, but, Schumann says, it didn't come off too well. Oh, they did a lot of things to diminish Paul and the others, Schumann says. They went out of their way to diminish them. William S. White wrote that the way to get into the Senate Club was to be courteous and courtly. Well, that's nonsense. Lehman was the most courtly man in the world, and he wasn't part of the club. It didn't have anything to do with courtly. It had to do with how you voted, with whether or not you voted as Lyndon Johnson wanted you to vote. says Neil McNeil, a longtime congressional correspondent for Time magazine. The Senate was run by courtesy, all right, like the Longshoremen's Union. Assistants to non-team members were constantly being reminded of their boss's lack of status. He, Johnson, was cutting to me, Edelstein recalls. With other staff people, he was very verbose, but when I said hello, he'd be very curt and turn his back on me. Sometimes Johnson would be chatting, outwardly relaxed, in the cloakroom, when he would notice, standing nearby, an assistant to one of the senators who was not on the team. "What the fuck do you want?" Lyndon Johnson would say. "Nothing, Senator," the aide would answer. "Then get your fucking ass out of here," Johnson would say. Or he would give these aides instructions for their senator in a tone that left no doubts as to where the senator stood in his estimation. Says Harry Schnibbe, administrative assistant to John A. Carroll of Colorado, elected to the Senate in 1956 and never a member of Johnson's team. "Most of the time he ignored you, but he might say, 'I want you to tell Carroll to get over here. Get on the phone and tell him. I need senators over here on this debate. You're over here listening to this. Where the hell is he?' Or he might simply tell Schnibbe in a low, threatening tone, 'Get your fucking senator over here right away.' I'd say, 'Yes, sir,' like I was a page," Schnibbe recalls. "I'd almost salute. He terrified me. To tell you the truth, if I went in the cloakroom and Johnson was in the cloakroom, I left. I'd say, 'Oh, shit, I'm not staying here.'" We all operated in total terror of Johnson. In other ways, too, the humility of Lyndon Johnson's first term fell away, to be replaced by characteristics that would have been familiar to students at San Marcos. To students, that is, who hadn't been on his team there. G-14 had been refurnished, almost instantly it seemed, thanks to the efficiency of the Senate cabinet shop, in the traditional Senate mode, turn-of-the-century desks and a visitor's bench, refinished and polished until it glowed, from the old Supreme Court chamber, a 19th-century painting of Rebecca, daughter of the mighty Powhatan, emperor of Attabalcomook. Johnson had admired portraits of John Nance Garner and a former Texas senator, Morris Shepherd, that had been hanging in Skeeter's back office. Now they were hanging in Johnson's office. At the end of the day, Johnson would, after, or increasingly instead of, a session in Skeeter's office, invite a few chosen senators or journalists to G-14 for a drink and a chat. Unbuttoning his double-breasted suit, he would put his feet, clad in either gleaming black shoes or gleaming, elaborately hand-tooled LBJ cowboy boots, up on the desk, and buzz a secretary to bring drinks. A "you ain't learning nothing when you're talking" plaque had been installed on the mantelpiece, but now, in sharp contrast to his first 6 years in the Senate, Lyndon Johnson paid markedly little attention to his father's advice, as little attention as he had paid before those 6 years. The most notable characteristic of these gatherings was the extent to which the conversation at them was dominated by one man. The talk was fascinating, but its dominant theme was the smartness, or to be more precise, the shrewdness of the host. Once, for example, on January 13, 1955, the day the committee assignments were announced, he was in the middle of a monologue when he abruptly interrupted himself. "My God," he said, "I forgot to call Senator Stennis and congratulate him." Snatching the phone out of its cradle, he tucked it between his shoulder and his chin and dialed Stennis's home. And when Mrs. Stennis, answering, said that her husband was not home, Johnson said, "Well, I must tell you, ma'am, how proud I am of your husband and how proud the Senate is, and you tell him that when he gets home. The Senate paid him a great honor today. The Senate elected your husband to the Appropriations Committee. That's one of the most powerful committees in the whole Senate, and a great honor for your husband. I'm so proud of John. He's a great American, and I know you're proud of him, too. He's one of my finest senators." A number of aspects of the monologue Johnson was conducting with Mrs. Stennis, a monologue that went on for quite some time, were worth noting. The first was the attention to detail, to doing everything. Giving Stennis the appropriations seat had put the senator in his debt. A telephone call like this would add a little to the debt. So, late though it was, long though Johnson's day had been, the call was made, and the call was not cursory. Johnson's conversation was not hurried, but slow and as drawlingly gracious as any Mississippian could have desired. Another was the use of the I and the my. As Roland Evans, one of the reporters listening, was to put it, implicitly he was belaboring the obvious, that it wasn't the steering committee or the full Senate that was really responsible. It was LBJ. But the most significant aspect of all was that as Johnson talked to Mrs. Stennis, buttering her up, he would, as he poured it on, wink and nod to his listeners, grinning at them over what he was doing. Although his words seemed sincere, he seemed to want his listeners to understand that they really weren't. It seemed to be important to him that they know that. The very ruthlessness with which Lyndon Johnson used his power helped him to amass more of it. The story of how Bernard Baruch's contribution had never reached Paul Douglas had gotten around, and everyone knew how Douglas's office had been taken away from him without warning or excuse. The ostracism of Herbert Lehman had been noted, and aides gossiped. It was an open secret now that some senators couldn't even get their phone calls returned. The United States Senate contained men adept at reading power, and they had no difficulty in drawing from these ongoing actions a unifying lesson. And new lessons were constantly being provided for their edification. A single attempt at independence could end an alliance with Lyndon Johnson forever, even if the alliance had been as long in duration and as intimate as that between Johnson and Stuart Symington. Symington had no jealousy of the Texan with whom he had spent so much time and exchanged so many favors. "I thought he was a man of destiny," he was to recall years later. And he had thought they were friends. "I was awfully fond of Lyndon B. Johnson," he was to say. But after Johnson put Symington on the Armed Services Committee, the experience and expertise, true expertise, in military matters of the tall, handsome Missourian, became apparent at Armed Services Committee hearings, and Johnson's aides became aware that he resented it. Johnson began to say, when Symington's name came up during private conversations, "He's not a team player." For a while, Johnson remained amiable when talking to Symington in person, but Symington, detecting a subtle change in Johnson's attitude, decided it was simply that I was getting too much prominence. He decided to play a less prominent role in future hearings, he was to recall. He didn't want anything to break up the friendship. But 1954 was the year of the Army-McCarthy hearings, and of Symington's courageous challenge to McCarthy, after Johnson had told him not to challenge McCarthy. And, Symington says, Johnson didn't like that at all. I've never quite known why, but it, standing up to McCarthy, was something that just had to be done, and I did it. And then, Symington recalls, I found out that if you crossed him, well, the one word that was foremost in his mind was power, and if anyone stood in his way, well, no one stood in Lyndon Johnson's way. Then Symington realized something about Johnson that he had not understood before, that there was a sort of cruelty there. He found out the hard way, in public. Because of the role he had played in building up Texas defense contractors, it had become a tradition for Symington to be invited to luncheons given by Texas's congressional delegation for prominent visitors from the state. Walking into a luncheon shortly after his confrontation with McCarthy, Symington strode over to his friend Lyndon, as he always did, and Lyndon turned his back on him. "I did not realize he was breaking with me before that," Symington recalls. "My goodness, only a few years before he had introduced me, at a Texas delegation luncheon, as the greatest Texan of them all. And he did it so that everyone saw it. Cruelty." Then Johnson did it so that everyone in the Democratic cloakroom saw it. In the past, whenever Bobby Baker circulated through the Democratic cloakroom at the end of the day inviting senators to drop by the leader's office, Symington would be one of the senators invited. Now, one day, he was standing with two senators when Baker approached. Taking the arms of the other two senators, Baker said to them, "The leader wants you in his office." He walked away. Symington realized he hadn't been invited, and for some years after that, he never was invited. He, Johnson, was deliberately leaving me out, and he was doing it in such a way that everyone would know. No one crossed Lyndon Johnson. Senators mutually recognized the primary natural law of political survival, Neil McNeil, a very perceptive observer, was to write. When a senator was asked for a vote, an excuse invariably accepted by most leaders was that it would be politically harmful in his home state. "Hell, I know what it takes to get elected," one of Johnson's predecessors as leader would explain. Even very pragmatic men recognized this law and accepted it. That was why, Scoop Jackson would later say, that if, despite President Kennedy's persuasiveness with a senator he had invited to the Oval Office, the senator said his people, constituents, wouldn't go along, Kennedy would finally say he was sorry they couldn't agree, but he understood. Johnson wouldn't understand. He would refuse to understand. Considerations important to the senator, even the consideration of political survival, did not divert him from his purpose. He could charm you or knock your block off, or bribe you or threaten you, anything to get your vote, Jackson would explain. And he'd get it. That was the difference. The lesson keen-eyed senators drew from what happened to Kefauver and Douglas and Lehman was spelled out by one of the keenest, Russell Long. Lyndon Johnson, Long said, could not bear to have anyone operating outside his camp. When he saw this developing, he would either reconcile or isolate them. And this made senators all the more anxious to be in his camp, anxious to be on his team. Men learned from watching what happened to Symington what Symington had learned the hard way. As for Senate loners, Russell Long said, he could make their lives miserable. Seeing what had happened to Symington, men made sure they didn't make Symington's mistake and cross Lyndon Johnson. As Frank Vanderlinden of the Richmond Times-Dispatch put it, "When somebody is ruthless like that and has the power and is willing to use it, weaker men get out of his way." And Lyndon Johnson, looking for power over the Senate, had found another instrument with which power could be created. It wasn't a new instrument. First employed in 1845, it had been formally embodied in the Senate Rules, Rule 12, Paragraph 3, since 1914, and previous Senate leaders had used it in a number of different ways. Never, however, had it been used as this leader used it. His use of it was, in fact, perhaps the most striking example of the creativity that Lyndon Johnson brought to the legislative process. The instrument was a unanimous consent agreement, a procedural device under which the Senate, by unanimous consent, agrees to limit the amount of time that a particular bill can be debated, to divide that time between the bill's proponents and opponents according to a prearranged formula incorporated in the agreement, and to place the allocation of that time under the control of one or two specific proponents and opponents of the measure, to limit the number of amendments to the bill that can be introduced and the amount of time each amendment can be debated, and to place that time, too, under the control of specific senators. Prior to World War II, most unanimous consent agreements had come near the end of a session, when the bill in question had already been debated for days, if not weeks. The Senate would then agree that after a certain number of additional days of debate, a vote would be taken. The mounting impatience after the war with the Senate's inefficiency had led to increased use of these agreements, but they still had generally been employed only after substantial debate on a measure had already occurred, and they still generally allowed additional time for debate. The 119 bills that had become the subject of agreements between the end of the war and the end of the 1954 Senate session had been debated for an average of 6 days before the agreements were instituted, and the agreements had allowed an average of 3 additional days of debate, so that a total of 9 days of discussion had been allowed before the vote. Lyndon Johnson wasn't allowing 9 days. Sometimes, in fact, he wasn't allowing even 1. Traditionally, says Assistant Parliamentarian Riddick, who had begun drafting more of the agreements as Parliamentarian Charlie Watkins grew older, it was sort of a practice to allow them to consider, debate, the bill a while to see if they anticipated a long debate. It was only if they saw that one could be expected that they would try to restrict debate. After Mr. Johnson came to the forefront, however, the agreements began coming earlier and earlier in the legislative process. You would get an agreement on some bills before you even started debate. Johnson would decline to call some bills, including some quite major bills, off the calendar onto the floor until a unanimous consent agreement had been worked out setting a strict time limit. The total debate on a bill might be only 6 or 4, or in some cases 2 hours. Nor was that the only difference. Until Johnson became majority leader, Riddick explains, most agreements were loose, just general agreements, many dealing only with time limits. Often they just set the number of hours or a set time at which they would vote. That was all many of them contained. You didn't work out all the details. Now the agreements became much stricter and much more detailed. What Mr. Johnson did was introduce the use of a detailed agreement as to how long each amendment would be debated, how long the general debate of the bill would last, whether all amendments had to be germane to the bill, and details of that nature. This was all reduced to unanimous consent agreements, even specifying the hour that you'd proceed to the consideration of said bill and the hour that you'd vote on it. Among the details now included, moreover, was the identity of the senators who would control the allocation of time to other senators who wanted to speak for or against the bill. In the past, the time given to a bill's supporters had usually been controlled by the senator who had introduced the measure, the mover, or by the senator who was managing it on the floor, or by the chairman of the committee from which it had emerged. Now, in more and more unanimous consent agreements, a new figure was named. Ordered by unanimous consent, that debate shall be limited to 4 hours, to be equally divided by and controlled by the mover of the bill and the majority leader, an agreement might say. Ordered that on the question of the final passage of such bill, debate shall be limited to 6 hours, to be equally divided and controlled, respectively, by the majority and minority leaders, said another. Sometimes, in fact, the time allotted to a bill's supporters was divided and controlled by the majority leader alone. Because of Lyndon Johnson's unprecedented intervention in committee work, the wording of the bills was often to an unprecedented extent a creation of the majority leader. He would previously have acted as a mediator between individual senators or between blocks of senators who were in conflict over an issue. Once the conflict would have been thrashed out on the Senate floor, but now Johnson would meet alone with each of the senators or get them together privately, explore their differences to find areas of agreement, and finally would ask, and if asking did not work, would urge, and if urging did not work, would demand, and finally, if all else failed, would use his raw power to threaten the senators to force them to consent, and to produce the consent of their allies, to the compromise he proposed, would, one way or another, arrange some wording on which they could agree, and for which he felt he could line up a majority of the Senate for passage. He would have been able to do this because of the power of Rayburn, the power of campaign funds, the power of scheduling, the power of office space, with which he had previously surrounded himself. The quid pro quo was seldom stated, seldom precise, seldom the offer of, say, a dam in return for a compromise on a specific bill. But the senator who needed the dam, or the campaign funds, or a private bill called off the calendar, would know that the man asking for this favor had the power to grant the other favor. Now, the bills that were already the creations of the majority leader, creations made possible by his new powers, would, under this additional new power, be managed on the floor by the majority leader. And Lyndon Johnson made sure, in each instance, that he had that power, beyond any question. When he resolved a point with the senator, he, or Reedy or Siegel, took notes on what the agreement entailed. Then the notes would be formally typed up. Recalls Riddick, Johnson would come up to me. Now look, I want you to type an agreement. And he would tell me what he wanted in it. For example, and I want to make sure there are no non-germane amendments. I would go down to Skeeter's office and have the agreement typed up. Then I would find him and give it to him. He would read it, and he might say, well, now change this so it will do so-and-so. In words that would equally apply to Johnson's maneuvers on the Gulf of Tonkin resolution 10 years later, Riddick says, Johnson wanted everything written to back him up as a record. He would get us, the parliamentarians, to sign the damned thing. He wanted it written down so he would be able to say, if anyone objected, well, you gave me this power. And, Riddick says, Johnson would take the formal document around and show it to senators. He would say, I hope you won't object. He would make it very difficult for a senator to object. Everyone else had agreed, he would say. We can't waste days debating this bill. We've got to make the Senate function. After he had secured everyone's consent, he would go to his front row center seat and stand by it, never for very long, until the presiding senator said, "The chair recognizes the distinguished majority leader." "Mr. President," Johnson would say, "I ask unanimous consent that a proposed unanimous consent agreement, which is offered on behalf of myself and the distinguished minority leader, be read." He would hold out the order that Riddick had typed, and a page would hurry over, take it, and give it to one of the clerks on the lower dais, who would read it into the record. "Is there any objection?" the presiding officer would ask. "The chair hears none. Without objection, so ordered." Lyndon Johnson's use of the unanimous consent agreement to drastically limit debate ran contrary to the principles on which the Senate had been founded, and to the customs which had, during the previous century and a half of its existence, been most fundamental in its functioning. Unlimited debate had been sacred Senate custom, the device by which, more than any other, it fulfilled the Founding Fathers' vision of it as the bulwark against the fickleness and transient impressions of the majority, as the guarantor of the sovereignty of the individual states. And it was debate, in its highest sense, unhurried, thoughtful discussion to educate first the Senate and then the people, to raise issues and examine them in depth and at length, that had made the Senate a great deliberative body. Johnson's agreements limited debate so drastically that, with their increased use, the very nature of the Senate was altered. From the moment a motion for one of his agreements was made on the Senate floor, the body's normally loose functioning was transformed into something very strict indeed. "Amendments to a unanimous consent agreement, out of order," is the laconic title of the section of Senate precedents relating to the matter. That means all amendments. There is, the precedents state flatly, no rule providing for amendment of unanimous consent requests. And not only can the agreement therefore not be modified, once the agreement has been approved, without objection so ordered, there is no appeal from it except by unanimous vote. A unanimous consent agreement can be set aside only by another unanimous consent agreement, by a vote that would be unobtainable should even one of the proponents of the original agreement want it to stand intact. As for the measure, the bill itself, covered by a unanimous consent agreement, its consideration is hedged about by rules very different from the normal Senate procedure, which allows virtually unlimited amendments and virtually unlimited debate. What if the senator who had introduced the bill now, listening to even the limited debate allowed, had a new thought, and, contrary to his earlier belief, realized that the bill should be amended? Under many agreements, no new amendment whatsoever could be introduced. Even in the rare cases in which new amendments were in order, they could only be introduced, not debated, which meant that their purpose could not be explained or discussed on the floor. Most Senate precedents dealing with unanimous consent agreements say that amendments must be presented and voted on without debate. What if a senator who has introduced an amendment on the floor before the agreement was ordered thinks that this proposed new amendment, modifying his, is a good idea? That does not change anything. Even where an amendment proposed by a senator to an amendment is accepted by the mover of the first amendment as a modification, further debate on such latter amendment is not in order. And in the even rarer cases in which discussion is in order, it could only be cursory. The time for debate on the modification of an amendment had to be subtracted from the already meager time, often a single hour, already allotted to the amendment. As employed by Lyndon Johnson, the unanimous consent agreement was even eliminating the tradition that a senator could introduce an amendment on any subject he wished, at any time he wished. Under Rule 14, one of the Senate's supposedly immutable rules, germaneness of amendments to bills is not required, except in the case of general appropriation bills or of bills being considered under the cloture rule. Nothing was more important to the guardians of the Senate traditions than that tradition. Russell held that the sacredness of Senate procedure was that you could amend anything, Riddick says. You could tack anything onto a farm subsidy bill, for example. There were no restrictions. But among the few exceptions to Rule 14 was the unanimous consent agreement. If a unanimous consent agreement contains a provision for germaneness of amendments, an amendment not germane is out of order. Most of Lyndon Johnson's unanimous consent agreements contained that provision. No amendment that is not germane to the provisions of the bill shall be received, Riddick would type. And the provisions of an agreement which gave control to a single senator, and more that senator was Lyndon Johnson, were, designed to ensure that that control was firm. Once the agreement was voted, the presiding officer no longer had authority to recognize a senator. A senator cannot be recognized unless time is yielded to him by one of the senators having control, the Senate rules state. So firm were such provisions that, as Riddick's chief assistant, Secretary to the parliamentarian Murray Zwebin, puts it, because of the unanimous consent agreements he devised, he, Lyndon Johnson, could keep major legislation from coming up. A senator could not introduce himself a major bill with provisions Johnson didn't like because Johnson wouldn't let it come to the floor. And he, the senator, couldn't offer it as an amendment to a different major bill because of the unanimous consent agreement on that bill. As for minor legislation, a senator had little hope of the amendment making its way into law by that route either, thanks to Johnson's power over scheduling. Johnson would simply not allow that bill to come to the floor. If a senator offered it, the amendment, to some piddling minor bill, that bill was dead, Zwebin says. The unanimous consent agreements were a culmination of all the powers that Lyndon Johnson had created over scheduling, over the content of bills, over the management of bills, over committee assignments. The agreements were made possible, senators had no choice but to accept them, because of the combining of these internal powers with the powers he brought to bear from outside the Senate. The power of Rayburn, the power of money. And the agreements cemented his power, made it formal as the wordings of the Senate orders in which the agreements were embodied. Of course, any senator could block unanimous consent and keep the debate going, Evans and Novak were to say. In fact, however, few did. Debates grew shorter and ever less important. Thus did Lyndon Johnson revolutionize the Senate, severely modifying its proud heritage of unlimited debate without changing a single rule. Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson may have been limiting debate on the Senate floor. He was not eliminating speeches. He wanted speeches, and he wanted plenty of them, the longer the better. Speeches, which he and his aides and most journalists persisted in calling debate, had their uses for him. The Lyndon Johnson version of debate, however, was not at all what the Founding Fathers had intended. The Founders had envisioned debate, thoughtful discussion, as an indispensable part of the Senate's main work. For Johnson, debate was a device to divert attention from the main work and to buy time for him to do it. As George Reedy explains, as long as somebody on the Senate floor is talking, the Senate cannot vote. From the time he became majority leader, therefore, Johnson began using talk on the floor as what Reedy calls a diversionary device, which enabled him to stay out of the spotlight while horse trading. As a smokescreen for the maneuvering that was taking place in the cloakrooms, or, more and more, in his top-floor Capitol office, as a method of stalling the Senate to give him time to work out his deals. There were, of course, senators who liked, loved to talk, and he used them. Hubert prepares for a major address by taking a deep breath, Johnson was to say, and whenever Johnson needed extra time for horse trading and a vote was inconveniently near, he invariably sent out Hubert H. Humphrey, who could stand up and deliver a discourse of 2 hours or more without previous preparation, Reedy recalls. Another was Molly Malone, that relic of Smoot-Hawley days, who could still rise at his desk to deliver a passionate and lengthy explanation of the need for high tariffs. Although Johnson held the opposite view of tariffs, when he needed to buy time because he didn't yet have the necessary votes for an upcoming vote on some non-tariff measure, he would often encourage Malone to give his views. It was the interlude he wanted, not the message, Harry McPherson says. While the quorum calls and speeches were droning on meaninglessly on the Senate floor, therefore, the action that mattered was taking place off the floor. When it was completed, the compromises made, the deal closed, the unanimous consent agreement in place. The time for talking was over, and Johnson had little patience with any senator who failed to understand that. A senator heading onto the floor to discuss the upcoming bill would be intercepted by Bobby Baker. Keep it short, or the leader will be mad, Baker would say. If the senator failed to take the hint, the leader, seeing him raising his hand for recognition, would hurry over to his desk. We've got the votes. Don't talk, he would whisper. Under Johnson, the Senate functions like a Greek tragedy, Paul Douglas was to say. All the action takes place off stage before the play begins. Nothing is left to open and spontaneous debate. Nothing is left for the participants but the enactment of their prescribed roles. This change in the nature of the Senate had a further implication. It was off stage, of course, in secret, that Lyndon Johnson himself liked to work. Debate was about goals, issues, about principled things. It is the politician's task to pass legislation, not to sit around saying principled things, he said, repeating that credo over and over. George Reedy was to write that he, Johnson, regarded public discussion as dangerous to the conduct of government. He was absolutely convinced that achievement was possible only through careful negotiations in quiet backrooms where public passions did not intrude. And, as Reedy notes, this attitude left no room in the LBJ philosophy for the Senate as a deliberative body in which speeches could change the outcome of legislation, or as an educational body in which speeches were intended to inform the public on the issues of the day. The role of public debate in securing popular assent to policies, and ultimately national unity, was a concept he could not grasp. Under this cloaking of Johnson's methods in governmental philosophy, however, lay something personal and deeper. The unanimous consent agreement, the key device by which Lyndon Johnson was changing the fundamental character of the Senate, was, in Doris Kearns Goodwin's words, a natural extension of his personality. Because he himself felt uncomfortable in larger groups and formal debate, he gradually shifted senatorial and public attention away from the floor to the places where he felt most at home, the cloakroom, the office, the hallways. Some of his assistants understood this fact. Discussions of goals and ethics were merely exercises in posturing, and he had no patience with such goings-on, Reedy was to write. He abhorred dissent to a point where he sought to quell it long before protagonists had talked themselves out. Disagreement, to this man to whom everything was personal, was disagreement not with his point of view, but with him. And, Colonel Bellew says, he had zero tolerance for disagreement. He abhorred dissent. He had no patience with discussions of goals and ethics. Even the loyal McPherson was to acknowledge that his constant pressure for unanimous consent agreements often came close to harassment. Although McPherson adds, but I could not fault him. Senators who raised objections had frequently benefited from his power. Complaints about limiting debate often turned out to be based on a plaintiff's annoyance that he must either miss a vote or forego a speaking engagement back home. And besides, who knew better than liberals the enervating consequences of unlimited debate? Other thoughtful men were as concerned as Paul Douglas about the consequences of this pressure. Lyndon Johnson did not believe it was a function of the Senate to inform and instruct the public, Julius Edelstein says. He believed it was the function of the Senate to pass legislation. But of course the Senate had always been the forum of the nation. The great tradition of the Senate was the tradition of Norris and Borah and La Follette. Such concern no longer had much significance, however. Lyndon Johnson had looked for power in the Senate and had found it, and now that he was majority leader, he was using it. During his first 6 years in the Senate, he had concealed certain aspects of his character, adapting his personality to the institutional personality of the Senate. But now, in the seventh year, he was forcing the Senate to adapt its personality to his. The adapting was, furthermore, taking place with remarkable rapidity. By June 1955, within 6 months of his election as majority leader, the unanimous consent agreements that were the legislative embodiment of Lyndon Johnson's personality had become, as Howard Schuman observes, the standard operating procedure on all big Senate bills. Debate beyond a sparse allotment of time became a favor which a senator had to request from the majority leader, Goodwin writes. The right to offer amendments? If Lyndon Johnson didn't want your amendment, you couldn't even offer it, Schuman says. He hated debate, and now in the Senate, once the very home of debate, debate was no longer important. In what had once been called the greatest deliberative body in the world, there was now very little real deliberation. So creative was Lyndon Johnson's political genius that it had transformed every political institution of which he had been the leader. Now it had transformed the United States Senate, remade that body, seemingly so immutable, in his own image. He could run it now, run it as he wanted to run it. Chapter 25. The Leader. On the Senate floor, late each morning, a clerk might be desultorily shuffling papers on the dais. Pages might be strolling through the deserted arcs of desks, laying out the daily calendar and the drafts of bills. One or two senators might be standing, chatting near the door of each cloakroom. Down in the well, a little knot of journalists, assembled for the daily briefing by the party leaders, might be listening to Minority Leader William Noland talk, in his ponderous, droning way, about the day's schedule. The Senate chamber was the sleepy, slow-moving place it had always been. And then, shortly before noon, the tall double doors at the rear of the chamber's center aisle would swing open, wide open, so hard had they been pushed, and Lyndon Johnson would be coming through them. As they swung, he would, without pausing, snatch the brown file folder Jerry Siegel was holding out to him, and toss an order to George Reedy out of the side of his mouth. And then he would be coming down the aisle's four broad steps with a long, fast stride. Seeing the journalists' heads turn, Noland, realizing Johnson was approaching, would stop talking. He would sit down at his desk, waiting to hear what the majority leader had to say. Johnson would stand by his desk, in the center of that broad semicircle of shining mahogany. Since he was on the first step, 6 inches higher than the floor of the well where the journalists were standing, he would be looking down at them from a height even greater than his own. And he also looked even taller than he was because the desk was so small. His thinning black hair was slicked down smooth, so that as his face turned to one side there was nothing to soften that massive skull or the sharp jut of the big jaw and the big nose, and when the face turned back, his eyes, under the heavy eyebrows, were those intent, intense, dark eyes, always wary, that could in an instant narrow into slits and become so intimidating. And under the eyes was the grim, tough line of Lyndon Johnson's mouth. He would stand there very erect, so tall and confident, just the model of a take-charge man, recalls one of the journalists. There was a nervous vitality that just poured out of him, almost an animal energy. And his physical presence wasn't the only reason he seemed so big. Other majority leaders who had met with reporters before each day's Senate session had traditionally been accompanied by assistants to fill in the details of the answers to the reporters' questions. No assistant accompanied Lyndon Johnson. He didn't need any. He knew the details himself. The file folder that Siegel had prepared contained the day's agenda, the calendar of bills, with notes on senators' views about various bills, and brief statements Johnson was to give. In the memory of the reporters who met with him regularly, Lyndon Johnson never, not once, opened that folder. Somebody might ask him about some minor bill, one reporter says. He'd say, "Oh, that's calendar number so-and-so." He knew the numbers without looking. Or he'd say, "That's not been discussed in committee yet. Looks like it might be coming out of the subcommittee this week." He knew where each bill was, exactly where it was. He knew the activities that had occurred in the various committee and subcommittee hearing rooms that morning, the arguments that had been made, the actions that had been taken, as if he had been present in every room. If you said, "Look, such and such committee just amended that amendment," he would say, "That new amendment is there because..." He seemed to know every aspect of everything the Senate had done or was going to do. Says another reporter, "He knew the Republican strategy, too. How, we didn't know. He might say, 'Now we're going to debate an hour on this. However, the other side will try to amend the amendment.'" He knew exactly what he wanted to say, what he wanted the journalists to know, and he said nothing more. As the journalists looked up at him, the clock over the double doors at the rear of the center aisle was in their line of vision. So they were constantly reminded that the bell would ring, bringing the Senate to order and their time to ask questions to an end, precisely at noon. He not only had his physical dominating presence, but the clock behind him, one of the reporters recalls. Not that he needed that assistance, or any assistance. There would be little time for questions, Booth Mooney would recall, nor any need for them, in Johnson's opinion. The majority leader of the Senate had given them a basis for their stories. What more could they ask? If there was a question that annoyed him, recalls one of the journalists, he would answer the question, but he would put a spin on it, so he would be saying it his way. That was the only way he answered any question. You didn't get any more than Lyndon Johnson wanted to tell you, a journalist says. Never. I don't think in all those years he ever slipped up. He knew exactly what he wanted to say, and that was what he said, period. I never felt in all those years that he ever lost control of one of those press conferences in the well. He was always in charge. Part of the aura that surrounded Johnson as he stood front row center in the Senate chamber was, as some reporters acknowledge, the build-up, the accrual, the knowledge we had of what this guy had done, of what this guy could do, of what he wanted to be. It was an aura of triumphs won, of triumphs anticipated. But the aura was more than reputation. Power just emanated from him, another of the reporters says. There was that look he gave. There was the way he held his head. Even if you didn't know who he was, you would know this was a guy to be reckoned with. You would feel, don't cross this guy. He was so big. And he would look around the chamber. It was like he was saying, this is my turf. More than a century before, a rider encountering big-eared, blazing-eyed John Wheeler Bunton on the Texas plains wrote of his unusual bearing. Others spoke of his towering form and commanding presence. For more than a century, those words and phrases had been applied to generation after generation of Buntons. Now they were being applied to the Bunton who had become majority leader of the Senate. He had the bearing of a man on a pedestal, one of the reporters in the well recalls. He had the bearing of a man in command. Then, at noon, the bells would ring, and the gavel of the senator in the chair, the Senator Lyndon Johnson had put in the chair, would rap, and the Senate would convene. And Lyndon Johnson would still be in command. The first words from Richard Nixon or Walter George or whoever was presiding in their place, after the chaplain's prayer and the ritualistic, "The Senate will be in order," were, "The chair recognizes the senator from Texas," and for some time thereafter, Johnson, standing at his desk in the center of the first row, would be the only senator recognized. It would be he who, after disposing of the parliamentary preliminaries, "On request of Mr. Johnson of Texas and by unanimous consent, the reading of the Journal of the Proceedings of May 25, 1955 was dispensed with," made the requests that only he could make, for permission for committees or subcommittees to meet, although the Senate was in session. "On request of Mr. Johnson of Texas, and by unanimous consent, the Subcommittee on Judicial Improvements of the Committee on the Judiciary was authorized to meet during the session today." The requests that had once been automatic, but that were no longer so automatic, that were an exercise of his power. It was he who ordered up the executive session. "Mr. President, I move that the Senate proceed to the consideration of executive business." Without objection, so ordered. And it was he who, during that session, shepherded the Senate through the advise and consent functions on nominations. The chief clerk read the nomination of Admiral Arthur William Radford to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The chief clerk read the nomination of General Maxwell Davenport Taylor to be chief of staff, United States Army. The chief clerk read the nomination of General Nathan Farragut Twining to be Chief of Staff, United States Air Force. Mr. Johnson of Texas, "Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent that the nominations be confirmed en bloc." Without objection, so ordered. And on treaties as well. "Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent that these treaties be considered as having passed through their various parliamentary stages up to and including the presentation of the resolutions of ratification, that the Senate take one vote on the treaties, and that President Eisenhower be notified of the Senate's action. All those in favor of ratification, please stand and be counted. 2/3 of those senators present having voted in the affirmative, the resolutions of ratification are agreed to." It was he who ended the executive session and moved that the Senate return to legislative business. It was he who ordered up the morning hour with its speeches, subject to the usual 2-minute limitation, and it was he who ended the morning hour, and it was he who, after the morning hour, stood again at his desk to recite the formula that by Senate custom only he could recite, that was so vital to senators. Mr. President, I move that the Senate proceed to the immediate consideration of calendar number 394, Senate Bill 2080, a bill for the relief of Oakley F. Dodd. Mr. President, I move that the Senate proceed to the immediate consideration of S. 2083, a bill to authorize a preliminary examination and survey of the channel leading from Indian River Bay to Assawaman Canal, Delaware. After each of these calendar calls, the legislative clerk had to participate in the ritual, stating the bill by its full title. A bill, S. 2083, to amend the Water Pollution Control Act in order to... And if the clerk was not reading fast enough, Johnson would become impatient. As he stood behind his desk, he was separated from the clerks on the second level of the dais only by the few feet of the well, and his eyes were on a level with theirs. Come on, let's get going," he would say to the clerk facing him across the well. And a few bills later, "Come on, get going!" Senators watching Lyndon Johnson intone the ritualistic words that called a bill off the calendar would know that they had bills over which they wanted, needed, that ritual intoned, and that only Lyndon Johnson could intone it. It was Lyndon Johnson who called up the non-controversial bills that had been reported out of committees, moved their consideration, and shepherded them efficiently through the process of passage. After the presiding officer had ordered a clerk to state the bill by title for the information of the Senate, and had then said, "The question is on agreeing to the motion of the senator from Texas," Johnson would either have the committee chairman briefly explain the measure, "I call the motion to the attention of the distinguished senator from Oklahoma," or would briefly explain it himself. And it was Lyndon Johnson who gave the Senate its schedule, in a tone of authority that let the Senate know that it was he, and he alone, who was establishing that schedule. "Mr. President," he would say, "I wish the Senate to be on notice that the Senate will consider on next Tuesday the State Department Appropriation Bill. The Mutual Security Bill probably will be reported to the Senate by then and be available for consideration on that day. It is my understanding that the Committee on Banking and Currency hopes to report a housing bill. If it is reported as expected, it is my hope that the housing bill be considered sometime next week. If action can be had on the minimum wage bill, it is my plan to schedule it for consideration by the Senate as soon as it is reported out of committee." He would make verbal gestures toward those who presumably were also involved in the scheduling process. "If the committees will report the bills, and I do not urge them to do so until they have thoroughly considered them and have reached full accord on them, the policy committee, and I'm sure the minority leader will cooperate as he has in the past, will schedule the bills quickly." But at the slightest hint that some other member of the Senate was daring to interject himself, no matter how slightly in the process, Johnson reminded him who was in charge. In May 1955, for example, Republican Charles Potter of Michigan, whose state was vitally interested in an early vote on the Great Lakes Fisheries Convention, a treaty with Canada, ventured to press Johnson a bit too hard on when the vote might be taken. "When did the majority leader say he would call up the convention?" Potter asked. "The distinguished senator from Michigan has spoken with me on several occasions about the Fisheries Convention," Johnson replied. "I am anxious to cooperate with him, as he has always cooperated with the Democratic side of the aisle, particularly with the leadership. If it is possible to call up the convention on next Tuesday, it will be done." On such occasions, Johnson's tone indicated clearly that if it wasn't possible, it wouldn't be done, and senators hearing the exchange could hardly help being reminded of what might have happened to Potter's cherished treaty if he had not always cooperated with the leadership. These matters of scheduling were mostly routine, on non-controversial bills, but there were also the controversial bills, the major legislation. Passage of such legislation, winning on the major bills, was as difficult for Lyndon Johnson as it had always been for majority leaders, for he was in as precarious a position as any of his predecessors. What position, indeed, could be more precarious than that of a leader with a one-vote margin, particularly when the party that was supposed to provide that margin was divided as deeply as his was divided. The Senate as a whole was divided on almost every major issue. With blocks of senators, mountain states senators, prairie states senators, northeast urban votes, southern caucus votes, certain to oppose one issue or another, there were few proposals on which a majority vote was certain. Because of these divisions, passage of most significant legislation required putting together, for each bill, a new unique collection of votes, and the margin would always be narrow. Every vote counted. And Lyndon Johnson needed on each separate major bill votes not only for the bill, but for the unanimous consent agreement that alone could ensure that the bill could be brought to a vote, and that the differences between voting blocks and between individual senators had been sufficiently bridged so that when the votes were counted he would have a majority. So each major bill was the subject of countless negotiations. Some took place in the chamber, on the Senate floor, on that floor on which, for generations, the prevailing pace had been the slow, hesitant steps of old men, on which the prevailing attitude had been the extremely dignified or over-dignified senatorial pomposity, on which the prevailing parliamentary procedure had often seemed to be the quorum call, the prevailing sound the drone of insignificant rituals. Now Lyndon Johnson was in charge of that floor. One moment he would be sitting down beside Kerr or Anderson on one of the couches in the rear of the chamber. The next he was up buttonholing a senator who had just entered, joking with him, draping an arm around his shoulders, and then talking confidentially to him, bending close to his ear. Then, seeing another senator come in, he would be off to greet him, crossing the long chamber. He would be throwing himself into the chair next to Richard Russell and talking with him out of the side of his mouth, or sitting down next to Walter George and, leaning forward, be bringing him up to date on the activities of the day, or jumping up would be heading across to another senator. Sometimes he would throw himself down in his own chair and, stretching his long legs out into the center aisle or crossing them, would lean far back into the chair and slouch down until he seemed to be resting on the nape of his neck and the small of his back. He might sit like that, lost in thought, for several minutes. And then, having arrived at some decision, he would lunge up out of the chair and stride rapidly over to some senator and begin talking to him. Even standing still, Lyndon Johnson was somehow always in motion, rocking back and forth on the balls of his feet, restlessly shifting his shoulders, one big hand plunging into a pants pocket to jingle coins or the keys on his big key ring, the other scratching his back, or scratching other parts of his body, too, for some of the motions Lyndon Johnson made front row center on the great stage of the Senate floor were those intimate motions that embarrassed other men even in the relative privacy of Johnson's office. The reporters in the press gallery would nudge each other and giggle when, jamming a hand into a side pocket of his pants, the leader quite openly scratched his crotch, bending one leg and leaning far over as he did so, one shoulder much lower than the other, the better to reach hard-to-reach recesses of his body. Sometimes, taking out his inhaler, he would tilt his head so far back that he was staring straight up at the ceiling, and shoving the inhaler far up his nose, he would snort so vigorously as he inhaled that the snorts were clearly audible up in the gallery. Sometimes, standing there, he might jam both hands into his pockets and rise up on his toes as he glanced around the chamber with that air of command. As the day wore on and the routine business was disposed of, and the crucial votes began to loom closer, his conversations would take on more intensity. Grasping a senator's arm, he would take him off to the side of the chamber for a quiet talk. One of his arms would be firmly around his colleague's shoulders, and after a while his other hand would begin to jab toward the other senator as he made his points. The jabs would no longer stop in midair. Lyndon Johnson's long forefinger would begin to poke into the other senator's chest. Or that hand, the other arm would still be around the shoulders, lest the senator try to get away, would reach out and take the senator's lapel, gently at first, but then harder, grabbing the lapel, pulling the senator closer or pushing him back. And Lyndon Johnson's big head would be down in the other senator's face, or twisting and cocking, coming up into that face from below. And he would be moving faster and faster, throwing himself down into a chair beside one senator to whisper urgently to him for a moment, then bounding up the steps to talk to another at the rear of the chamber, then, seeing another on the far side of the chamber, crossing the center aisle, hurrying through the Republican desks with those long strides, leaning forward in his haste. Or he would beckon Bobby Baker over to him, lean far down to whisper right in Baker's ear so that no one else could possibly hear, and Baker would dart away. Or Baker would rush out of the cloakroom and over to Johnson and whisper up into his ear, and Johnson would rush up to the cloakroom. And even if he was just standing there jingling the coins, you couldn't take your eyes off him, says Robert Barr of U.S. News and World Report. If you were a spectator and you didn't know who he was, you would wonder who he was, because of this unbelievable restless energy that emanated from him. The Senate chamber, which had been so sleepy and slow, was now suddenly a room filled with energy and passion. Then the unanimous consent agreement would be almost finalized, almost but not completely, or if the agreement was finalized, the times fixed in writing at which the roll would be called on the amendments and the final bill, he might have almost enough votes for passage, almost but not enough. And all too often in that divided and stubborn Senate, it seemed as if he would not be able, despite all his efforts, to get enough. And he had to have enough, had to win. Striding up the aisle, Lyndon Johnson would push open the double doors to the Democratic cloakroom. Bobby Baker would hold out a tally sheet. Johnson would snatch it out of his hand. And Baker, who had been trying to make sure that all Johnson's votes would be on the floor when they needed to be, would also have lists of the senators whom he had been unable to locate, or who had other commitments and had said they couldn't be present, or who, for one reason or another, did not want to vote with the leadership on the upcoming bill. And he would have information for Johnson about disputes between two senators, or about the bill, amendments on which there was still no acceptable compromise. "Get 'em on the line for me," Johnson would say, and Baker would give the numbers to the telephone clerks, and the first call would go through into Booth 10, the telephone booth closest to the clerks' desks. The matter to be discussed might be only one of attendance, and then Johnson might only say into the telephone, "Lister, we're going to motion up the district bill tonight, and I want you to be standing by. I'll need you over here. I'm not even going to tell the Republicans until I bring it up, and I want you guys to be ready." But the matter might be more delicate. Then the door to Booth 10 would close, and a senator or aide passing by would see Lyndon Johnson hunched over the phone inside. One hand would be holding a cigarette, from which he would take frequent deep drags. The other would be holding the receiver, and Johnson's mouth would be very close to it. As he spoke into it, he would sometimes rise to his feet, his tall body filling the booth, or he might remain seated and hunched over on the little seat. But, standing or sitting, if he was having difficulty persuading the senator on the other end of the line to his way of thinking, Lyndon Johnson's whole being would be poured into that persuasion. His head would be bowed low over the mouthpiece, and sometimes as he talked and he became more and more wound up in his effort, he would lower his head until it was beneath the receiver, and then it would cock to one side and come up under the receiver as if it was the senator's face. Sometimes Johnson would want to make sure that nobody could hear what he was saying. "If you stepped out of Booth 10, you could see the whole cloakroom," one of the telephone clerks recalls. And he would stand up, open the door of the booth, and look around the corner to see if anyone could hear. Then Lyndon Johnson would duck back into Booth 10 to say the things he didn't want anyone else to hear. What he said might have the desired result, and he would replace the receiver, step out of the booth, and snatch up the phone in the next booth, where the clerks had another senator waiting on the phone. Or it might not have the desired result. Then, as the conversation came to a close, Johnson, still inside the booth, door closed, might kick the booth as he hung up, or pound his fist into its wall. In the cloakroom, men would watch the booth shaking with the leader's rage, or, stepping out of the booth after hanging up the phone, his face the thundercloud that men feared, he would kick the outside of the booth, viciously, as one Senate staffer puts it, or slam the door. By this time there would be lights, signals that senators were waiting for him on the line, over several booths. He would go right down the row, getting his players lined up, the telephone clerk says. Often, while he was talking to one senator, a call he needed to take immediately would come in on another line. A clerk would tap timidly on the door of the booth in which Johnson was talking, and tell him the other senator was ready. Stepping out of the booth, the telephone still in his hand, the cord stretching with him, Johnson would reach into the other booth and take that receiver, and then stand between the two booths, with the cords stretching out from them to his hands. Or he might want to talk to two or three or even four of his players, senators with disagreements about the same amendment, at the same time. And he talked to them at the same time, on two or three or four phones, standing in the narrow aisle between the two rows of phone booths with a receiver or two receivers grasped in each big hand, talking first into one receiver, then into another, long black cords stretching out from his tall figure in all directions. Sometimes this telephone persuasion would be successful. Then, moving from booth to booth, Johnson would slam the receivers back into their cradles, a thin smile of satisfaction on his face. Sometimes it wouldn't. Then, with a grimace of disgust and fury, Johnson would drop the receivers or hurl them to the floor so hard that they bounced and their cords would still be quivering when a clerk scurried to pick them up. He would smash his foot into one of the booths so hard that it shook, and as he strode out of the cloakroom back entrance to collect himself in the corridor outside, the telephone area still vibrated with Lyndon Johnson's rage. Or, the clerk recalls, he might look around the corner of booth 10 to see if anyone was in the cloakroom that he wanted to work on. If there was, Lyndon Johnson would go over to him to persuade in person. The quarry might be seated on one of the leather couches that lined the cloakroom walls. They were low and soft, ideal locales for persuasion, in the words of the clerk, good places for him to pin a senator into so that he couldn't get away. Approaching the senator, Johnson would lean over him, perhaps chatting amiably for a moment or two about inconsequential matters, but with his weight resting on one hand that had been placed on the back of the couch, close by the senator's shoulder. Then, switching to the real subject of the conversation, Johnson would sit down beside him. The hand would remain on the back of the couch, so that when Johnson, continuing to talk, leaned forward to look the senator more directly in the face, his arm would be stretched out beside the other man's head. In the urgency of his appeal, Johnson would lean further forward, sliding to the edge of his seat, and twist his body so that it was more in front of the senator. Then he would cross the leg furthest from the senator over the knee closest to the other man. Already faced with the difficulty of pushing up from those deep, soft cushions, the senator would find the difficulty increased by the fact that not only was there a big arm like a bar on one side of him, but also a big leg like a bar in front of him. If the senator exhibited signs of restlessness, Johnson would grab the ankle of that leg with his free hand, so that there were in effect two bars in front of the senator, not to mention a size 11 shoe in front of his face. The poor guy, the clerk notes, couldn't get out. With the senator's continued presence thus assured, the first Johnson arm, the one that had been resting on the back of the couch, would stretch along it so that the senator was almost completely surrounded. And the trap would be tightened. As Johnson talked faster and faster, that heavy arm would come down around the senator's shoulders, hugging them. His hand would grasp the senator's shoulder firmly. He would lean further and further into him, the hand that had been on his own ankle now on the senator's knee or thigh. "I can still see those big, meaty hands," the clerk would recall decades later. "One would be massaging the poor guy's shoulder, and the other one would be grabbing his leg. I can still see Johnson leaning into him." His face would be very close to the senator's now, pushing closer and closer, his head coming up under his companion's, so that the senator's head was often forced back against the back of the couch. No matter how much he may have wanted to retreat further, he couldn't, and as he was held helpless, Johnson would talk faster and faster, pleading, cajoling, threatening. Some of these sessions on the cloakroom couches, or in the deep, soft cloakroom armchairs, better even than the couches for Johnson's purposes, since by sitting down on one armrest and stretching an arm across to the other he could imprison its occupant more effectively, lasted quite a long time. He had to win, and to win he needed the senator's vote, and he wasn't going to get up until he got it. "I've seen him devote an hour to work on one senator," the clerk says. Then that vote would be secured. Lyndon Johnson would be up off the couch, standing in the center of the cloakroom, dispatching Humphrey or Molly Malone to hold the floor with a speech. "Don't quit talking till you see me back in there." asking Russell or Eastland to exert his influence with one of their conservatives, or Humphrey to exert his influence with one of his liberals. Going over the tally sheets again, reading, quickly but with great care, the latest text of an amendment, ironing out the last details of the unanimous consent agreement, and then sending Baker on the run to have Floyd Riddick's fastest typist type it up. And then he would have the agreement back, and holding it in one hand and shoving open the double doors with the other, Lyndon Johnson would come back out on the floor to announce it. Or, if he had not been able to get an agreement, to push the Senate to a vote without it, with, in his hand, the tally sheet that almost invariably showed that the vote was going to be very close. If he had the votes, debate, even the limited debate permitted under the unanimous consent agreement, could only hurt, could allow opponents to realize what he was up to, could give Noland time to get a more accurate count, could give men whose minds he had changed with his relentless persuasion time to change their minds back, to think better of what they had agreed to. He wanted the question called, and called fast. Although the unanimous consent agreement allowed a certain number of hours or minutes for debate, he wanted to be able to yield his time back and have his opponents yield their time back. "Don't talk, we've got the votes. Don't talk, we've got the votes," Bobby Baker would whisper, standing at the corridor door to the cloakroom as the senators came through on the way to the chamber, which, with a vote imminent, was beginning to fill up. Some senators didn't get the idea and insisted on speaking. "I'd go up to him, Johnson, on the Senate floor and say, 'Senator Lehman would like to have the floor as soon as possible,'" Julius Edelstein recalls. "He'd say," and as Edelstein shows Johnson's response, his face twists into a snarl, "Well, he can have the goddamned floor." Rushing over to Edelstein, Jerry Siegel said, "I know Lehman has to talk for his constituents, but make it short. Make it short. Otherwise, it'll make the leader mad." As a supporter of a measure was rising to speak, Johnson would go over to the supporter's desk and growl, "Make it short. I've got the votes for it." The reminders would continue during the senator's statement. Once, Richard Neuberger of Oregon was giving an impassioned statement at a moment Johnson considered propitious for a vote. Johnson whispered to him to stop, but Neuberger didn't. Circling Neuberger's desk, in John Steele's words, "like a coon dog does a treed animal," Johnson whispered to him from in back and then to the right side to tell Neuberger to knock it off. Olin Johnston's southern drawl was so slow. "Olin," Johnson whispered urgently, "get the lead out of your ass." "Lyndon," Johnston said calmly, "you know I always read slow," says a Senate staffer who was standing nearby. Then Olin goes back to reading. I thought Lyndon was going to have a fit. Looking on another occasion at a speech that Olin was insisting on reading, Johnson saw to his dismay that it covered quite a few pages. 2 minutes, that's all I can give you," he said. "You've got to hold it to 2 minutes." Johnson kept refusing. "Olin," Lyndon said, forcing a comradely smile to his face, "why don't you speak for 2 minutes, and tomorrow you can put your whole speech in the Congressional Record, and you can mail it to all the folks in South Carolina, and they won't know the difference." "Well, I guess that's all right, Lyndon," Johnston said, and read only a small part of the text, so quickly, an observer said, that he scarcely could be understood. The long arcs would be filling up now, senators coming in and walking along them to their desks, and then standing talking quietly with a colleague or sitting listening to the debate on the proposed bill, as if a painter, having finished the background, was putting in the figures. Other senators would have congregated in the well, bantering with each other in the relaxed senatorial way. The chamber floor would be the familiar, still Senate tableau. Except that on that floor there would be one figure who, now, with the vote coming closer, seemed never to be still. He was prowling the big chamber now, ranging restlessly up and down, side to side. He rarely listened to the debate, except occasionally for a moment or two to see if the speaker was saying anything he hadn't anticipated.
End of Disc 25.